Good evening. Welcome back to Wednesday Night Bible Study. I'm Richard Misservi, and as you know, we are taking a journey through the book of Deuteronomy. Pop quiz tonight, and I can hear the groans all the way through the internet. But if I were to ask you, what secular document does the book of Deuteronomy resemble? You would say, exactly. A treaty document, what is known in the field as a suzerain treaty document. A suzerain is a king or a great king over many nations, and a vassal is a subject king underneath the great king. And the great king would establish a relationship between the great king and the little kings, and that would be written down into a document, and each of the parties would keep a copy of the document. And the elements of that document are very closely resemble what we have in the book of Deuteronomy. And they are the expression of the relationship between the vassal and the king. And those elements, we looked at this before. There's a preamble, who the king is, who the people are. There's a historical prologue, what he has done for them, and where they stand. And then there are general stipulations of what their responsibility is. They're going to be faithful to the great king. They're not going to go to war against him and rebel against him. And then after the general stipulations, there are specific stipulations. You're going to give me so many men for my armies. You're going to give me so many baths of oil, so many talents of gold. Then there was a document clause to store the document so that each of the parties would have it. And then there would often be a call for divine witness. Like, my God is witnessing that I'm committing to this document, and your God is committing to yours, and they'll exert the punishments that are necessary if we violate it. And those punishments and benefits of the relationship are outlined in blessings and cursings. And what we saw is that these very elements are in the book of Deuteronomy. And what we have done so far, we've looked at essentially the preamble, who the Lord is, the historical prologue, what he did to deliver the people from Egypt, how he led them through the wilderness. And the general stipulations were that you shall love him. There are 10 laws that he has given, 10 commandments. You're going to love him. You're going to serve him. You're going to be faithful to him. These are all general. Coming after that, there are specific stipulations. And that's what we see in chapter 12 through 26. We're in chapter 11 tonight. It's a transition chapter between the general and the specific. And in fact, it acts as a mini covenant document. It has a prologue, what the Lord has done and what you've seen, and then a requirement to follow him and to be faithful to him. And then there are the stipulations, the call of a covenant commitment to him, and witnesses that would witness that commitment. And so chapter 11 then is an important chapter. It is the climax of 1 through 10, and it's the transition to chapter 12, which we'll start next week, looking at more specific laws. We've only looked at laws in general. So a basic outline that I'm going to follow tonight is in verses, this is chapter 11, verses 2 through 7, an emphasis on the Lord, considering his person and his power. Then we're going to look at the land, the land gift, the promise that the land, promise of the land that the Lord is giving to them. And it's a good land that he cares for. 18 through 25 is an emphasis on the word It's a call to carefully following the law of God that he has given to them. And then finally, 26 through 32, there is the call to commitment, an emphasis on the covenant response, that here the great king has done this for you and promises to do that for you. Now, call to respond to him. So if you would turn in your Bibles to Deuteronomy chapter 11. Now, we read verse 1 last week when we were looking over the works of the Lord and then the requirements that he commanded the people. So in 11:1, you shall therefore love the Lord your God and keep his charge, his statutes, his rules, and his commandments always. And verse 2, consider or know today, since I'm not speaking to your children who have not known or seen it. That is, this is a generation, the fighting men died in the wilderness, but there are other people that didn't, that they were alive for the exodus from Egypt, and they wandered through the wilderness with the people. Consider then the discipline or the teaching, the chastening, the lesson of the Lord, your God. Consider his greatness, his mighty hand, and his outstretched arms, his signs and his deeds that he did in Egypt to Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, and to all his land, and what he did to the army of Egypt, to their horses and to their chariots, how he made the water of the Red Sea flow over them, and as they pursued after you, and how the Lord has destroyed them to this very day. So here, it's the mini covenant document begins with who the Lord is and what he has done for them. And what he has done is he has delivered them from Egypt by his power and his redemption from Egypt. And so they're told to consider this. Think about this. Know this. Be aware of this. And these force them to think of the person and the power of God in their behalf. And he works his salvation for them. Then in verse 5, though, his power is not only revealed against their enemies. His power is also revealed against those in their midst that rebel against him. So in verse 5, and consider what he did to you in the wilderness until you came to this place. What he did to Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab, the son of Reuben, and how the earth opened its mouth and swallowed them up with their households, their tents, and every living thing that followed them in the midst of all Israel. For your eyes have seen all the great work of the Lord that he did. Now here's the negative power. This is this, you can look this up in Numbers chapter 16, where there was a great rebellion against Moses. Korah and these two men, Dathan and Abiram, said, "Who are you to lead us? You're not that great." And they rebelled against Moses, and Moses, went before the Lord, and he told the nation of Israel, stand away from those guys, walk away. The car is going to explode. move away. And in fact, he said, if the earth doesn't open up and swallow them up, then the Lord hasn't called me to be your leader. And in fact, the earth opened up and swallowed Dathan and Abiram and Korah, all their tents and their dwellings, their families, everything. And what we find is that the work of the Lord is a holy work, and he works through his chosen leader. And when they rebelled against Moses, they rejected the Lord who had chosen him. If you read through the Bible, in the book of Acts, for example, there is Stephen's speech shows the rebellion against the leaders, the prophets, Moses, in the nation of Israel, and how the final climax was a rejection of the one that came in his name, the Lord Jesus Christ. So this is the case. If you reject the one that the Lord has chosen, then you reject the Lord. So first of all, think about the Lord, what he has done and what he is doing for you. And then second, in verse 8, the land. Consider the promise that God has given you, and you're about to enter in to take and enjoy. So verse 8, you shall therefore keep the whole commandment that I command you today, that you may be strong and go in and take possession of the land that you're going over to possess, and that you may live long in the land that the Lord your God swore to your fathers to give them and to their offspring, a land flowing with milk and honey. So here first we have the commandments of God to keep his law, to obey him. And as a result, then, you're going to receive the possession of the land. And you're going to live there. You're going to enjoy there. You're going to enjoy the abundance that he has given you. So the idea here is it's a conditional requirement that if you do this, then the Lord will do that. And if you don't do this, he won't. The condition is that that we are faithful to him and we walk in his ways. We trust him and we put our faith in him and we're faithful to him. And then he describes the land and contrasts it, first of all, with the land of Egypt. If you look at the end of verse 9, he calls it a land flowing with milk and honey. It's a little ironic to me. In number 16, where Dathan and Abiram rebelled against him in Korah, they said, Moses, you took us out of a land flowing with milk and honey. But in fact, he's bringing them into a land that's flowing with milk and honey. But in verse 9, a land flowing with milk and honey. In verse 10, for the land that you are entering to take possession of it is not like the land of Egypt from which you have come, where you sowed your seed and irrigated it like a garden of vegetables. But the land you are going over to possess is a land of hills and valleys, which drinks water by the rain from heaven, a land that the Lord your God cares for. The eyes of the Lord your God are always upon it from the beginning of the year to the end of the year. So here's a land of blessing, and the blessing that he specifically mentions is that of rain. So it says in verse 10 that you irrigated, or the more literal, the King James Bible says you watered it by foot, or NIV, you irrigated it by foot. The NLT, you made irrigation ditches with your foot. And the idea, and they have pictures of this that they have found, is, you know, they would have a pole to attached to a container to pick up water from the Nile and drop it into the channels, water courses, which they could block off or open up depending on where they wanted to go. And they would do it with mounds of dirt or with some kind of mechanical blockage, but operated by their foot. And what he says is that this is not going to be the case when you move into the promised land. You're not going to have a single river that flows, but the Lord your God is going to give you rain. As it says, he cares for this land and his eyes are upon it. One translation says he looks out for this land. Daniel Block says that his focused attention and constant providential care is upon this land. And Moses says God's eyes are upon it. Now, he just told us in the last paragraph, your eyes saw what the Lord did, that your concentration is on him and what he's done. But his eyes, they're on the land, and he's providing for you with rain. He cares for that land, and he provides rain and water for that land. But remember, it's conditional. In verse 13, if indeed you will obey my commandments that I command you today, to love the Lord your God and to serve him with all your heart and with all your soul, he will give you the rain for the land in its season, the early rain and the latter rain, that you may gather your grain, your wine, and your oil. And he will give grass in your fields for your livestock, and you shall eat and be full. That this is the conditional promise of you respond to him, he will then provide for you. And then in verse 16, he gives a warning. There's a caution. Take care lest your heart be deceived, that you might, that is, you might be lured away or seduced and turn aside and serve other gods and worship and bow down to them. The consequences, verse 17, then the anger of the Lord will be kindled against you, and he will shut up the heavens so that there will be no rain, and the land will yield no fruit, and you will perish quickly off the good land that the Lord is giving you. So here's the idea here of the land is, the land is a gift. It is God's blessing to you. It is his covenant gift to you. But your enjoyment of it, your living there is conditional upon you following the Lord. The Lord's blessings are not for you when you reject the Lord. And the most, the essential blessing that he has is water. Life comes from water. And the Lord then is the source of that life. And the idea is that if you follow him, then you will enjoy his blessing. But if you reject him, then there will be no rain upon them. So the essence here, as he said, don't be deceived or root. And the root for that is the root for that is from to be simple. It's the fool in the book of Proverbs. And the idea is, the wise person is going to follow the word of the Lord and enjoy his benefits. The foolish person is going to turn away from him and then lose out. We just sang on Sunday that hymn, "My Jesus, I love thee, I know thou art mine, for thee all the follies of sin I resign." That's what Moses is saying. Don't be seduced, don't be lured away. And what we find if you look at this theme through the rest of the Old Testament, you find over and over and over again this very truth that God withholds rain and therefore the crops don't grow and therefore there is famine. In 1 Kings chapter 8 Solomon's prayer of dedication of the temple when they build it in the promised land. And part of that prayer, he says, is when heaven is shut up and there is no rain because they have sinned against you, if they pray towards this place and acknowledge your name and turn from their sin when you afflict them, then hear from heaven and forgive the sin of your servants, your people Israel, when you teach them the good way which they should walk, and grant rain upon your land which you have given to your people as an inheritance. We see this again in Elijah goes to Ahab, the king, and he says, "Except at my word, there will not be rain or dew in this land." And there isn't rain until there's a showdown with the priests of Baal and the prophets of Baal, and they're put to death. Then he sees that cloud the size of a man's hand, and he says, "Run, better run, because the clouds are going to be pouring out rain." But the idea being that when the people stray from God, there is a physical revelation of God's pleasure or displeasure with them, and they don't have the rain that they they need. The prophets take up the same theme. Hosea says, sow for yourselves righteousness, reap steadfast love, break up your fallow ground, for it is time to seek the Lord that he may rain righteousness upon you. Isaiah 45, shower, O heavens, from above. Let the clouds rain down righteousness. Joel, be glad, O children of Zion, and rejoice in the Lord, for he has given the early rain for your vindication and has poured down for you abundant rain, the early and latter rain as before. And it shall come to pass afterwards that I will pour out my spirit upon all flesh. That there is a hope in the Bible that not only would God give physical rain so that they prosper and their crops grow, but there would be a rain of the righteousness of God, that there would be a rain of the pouring out of his spirit. And we see this fulfilled, don't we, in the New Testament, that God fulfills his word to bring refreshing on the earth through the power of his spirit, that this hope is fulfilled not just in physical rain that they experience, but in the spirit of life, which is water of refreshing to those that are parched in a dry land. And how he warns them of the most dangerous thing they face. We looked at all the different dangers, but the most dangerous thing is that they would turn away from the Lord and follow false gods, that they would play the fool. And in verse 18 through 21 is the antidote to that problem. And the antidote is the word of God and the commitment to him. If you look at verse 18, you shall therefore lay up these words of mine in your heart and in your soul. You shall memorize these words of mine. And you shall set them in your heart. It's more than just memory. It is also yielding to them, committed to them, and living them out. So the NIV says, fix these words of mine in your hearts and minds. The New American Standard, impress these words on your heart and soul. The NLT, commit yourselves wholeheartedly to them. And then he says, and you shall bind them as a sign on your hand. They shall be as frontlets between your eyes. You shall teach them to your children, talking of them when you're sitting in your house and when you are walking by the way, when you lie down, when you rise. You shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates, and that your days and the days of your children may be multiplied in the land that the Lord swore to you, to your fathers, to give them, as long as the heavens are above the earth. So now you remember this, right? We looked at these very words in Deuteronomy chapter 6. You remember the Shema of Israel. Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one, or the Lord alone. And you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your strength. And then Moses says that you shall set them on your heart, you shall bind them on your hand, you talk of them to your children when you're walking, when you rise, when you go to bed, when you go in the house, when you go out of the house. All of these things he's already told us. So I say to myself, why do you have to repeat yourself again? And the answer is because you are dumb. Because you don't remember what I told you, what's important. And that's the point of this chapter is there's no new information here. It is all the same thing that he's told us before, and he's driving it home so that when they go into the land, they will actually practice these things. Now, the binding on the hand and the frontlets on the arm are what's known as the tefillin. They would have little boxes on their hand and on their head for prayer time. And the people debate whether that was meant to be literal or figurative. Surely, if it's literal, it's not enough if your heart is not in it to worship the Lord. But here, the idea is you bind these on your hand, and you put them on your head as visible signs that you're following the law of God. But that's not enough. It also requires the heart that is following the Lord. And this is what Jesus said when, you know, you do all these things, you tithe, you do everything according to the law, but you've rejected the weightier matters of faithfulness and love and mercy. You should go and learn what this means, that I desired mercy, not sacrifice. So here, the idea is that if you bind these, you talk about them, you write them on the gates of your on the doorposts of your house and on your gates, God promises that your days will be long and multiplied on the earth. You'll enjoy the life that God has promised you in the land. And this is the promise. This is the covenant promise that we've seen. He promises the land to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Now they're entering in and seeing the fulfillment of that promise, but they don't own this land. It's still, even though it's a gift, it's God's land. And it will spew them out if they don't follow faithfully to him. But if they do follow faithfully, then you can expect life to be multiplied, your children multiplied, and the days long in your life. And this is why I call this the antidote for being seduced by other gods. That here is a lifestyle of the word of God filling the heart, filling the mouth, filling the lives, so that they are not tempted to follow the other gods. And we saw this before in chapter 6, that the words are on your heart, they're on your lips, they're on your hand and head, they're on your doorposts, they're on your gates, everywhere. And that this is a lifestyle that Moses is requiring for them as a covenant people. It's not just a part of you, but it's all your heart, all your soul, all your strength. It's not external only, but it's in your heart and your thought and your will and your longings and desires. It's not just you alone, but you speak of them to your children, your household. They're not internal only. They're written down. They're written on your hand, on your arm, on your doorposts, on your gates of the town. They're not public only. They're in your house. And they're not private only. They're in your gates. So this is the Shema lifestyle, and it is a walk of faithfulness to the one that gave you all these blessings that Moses is outlining. So bottom line for this whole section is that it is a conditional promise. If, in verse 22, if you will be careful to do all this commandment that I command you to do, loving the Lord, walking in his ways, holding fast to him. If you do this whole commandment, loving the Lord, walking in all his ways, holding fast to him. If you do this whole commandment, loving the Lord, walking in all his ways, and holding fast to him, then I will drive out your enemies, verse 23. They will fear you, verse 25. And every place your foot treads, that is, you follow the ways of the Lord, every place you go will belong to you. And then he gives you a description of the extent of the promised land. So this is all the covenant promises, right? He's promising a land, and then he's telling you the extent of that land. In verse 23, the Lord will drive out all these nations before you and will dispossess nations greater and mightier than you. Every place on which the sole of your foot treads shall be yours. Your territory shall be from the wilderness of the Lebanon, that's far north, and from the river, that's the Euphrates, to the Western Sea, the Mediterranean Sea. No one will be able to stand against you. The Lord your God will lay the fear of you and the dread of you on all the land that you tread, as he promised you. And this actually was fulfilled under the reign of Solomon. 1 Kings 4, Solomon ruled over all the kingdoms from the Euphrates to the land of the Philistines, which is on the Western Sea, to the border of Egypt. They brought tribute and served Solomon all the days of his life. So he was the suzerain, they were the vassals. And 1 Kings 4:24, for he had dominion over all the region west of the Euphrates, from Tiphath to Gaza, over all the kings west of the Euphrates, and he had peace on all sides around him. And Judah and Israel lived in safety, from Dan, that is the furthest point in Israel to the north, to Beersheba, the furthest point to the south, every man under his vine and under his fig tree, all the days of Solomon. That the covenant promises of God were fulfilled because the people, through David, Solomon, followed the Lord. But as we know, they were not always faithful. And when you read on in the story, you find that God was just as faithful to fulfill his threats as he was to fulfill his promises. And when the people turned away from him, they were exiled from the land and brought into judgment. And that's why this whole section is Moses is calling the people to respond properly so they enjoy the blessing of God. It's really, this whole section is like the preacher we've seen. These are oral speeches of Moses to the nation of Israel on the brink of the promised land. And now he's coming to the altar call. You can hear if the temple, the musicians are starting to play "Just As I Am" without one plea. He is bringing to them a call to obedience. And he reveals it as a call to enjoy life or the curse of God. It's blessing or curse that follows the covenant commitment. So look at verse 26. See, I am setting before you today a blessing and a curse. The blessing if you obey the commandments of the Lord your God, which I command you today. The curse if you do not obey the commandments of the Lord your God, but turn aside from the way that I am commanding you today to go after other gods that you have not known. So he's calling them to a choice. Choose whether to serve God or other gods. And we find this throughout the whole Bible. You're familiar with Joshua at the end of his life. He said, choose you this day whom you will serve. You might not be able to serve the Lord, but as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. That call comes over and over again. Every generation has to answer the call to either be faithful to the Lord or to walk away from him. And every individual within that generation has to respond to the same call. That even if the whole generation is unfaithful and walks away, I'm still responsible for my choice. You know, when that song we sing, you know, though none go with me, still I will follow. I will follow the Lord. And so this choice is, which God am I going to serve? And then am I going to receive blessings or curses from him? This land is a gift, but as one man said, it's also a test. It's a test to know whether or not I will look to the giver of the land or just to the land itself. You cannot choose other gods, what Moses is saying, and expect to receive the blessings of God. And finally, it is a commitment to keep or obey his commandments, right? So he said, if you obey, you get this. If you disobey, you get that. And this in this chapter, like six times, he says the same thing. It's like the refrain of a song that just goes over and over and over again to drive in their heart. In verse 11, keep his commandments. In verse 8, keep the whole commandment. In verse 13, if you obey my commandments to love and to serve and to be careful to do all his commandments. 22, blessing if you obey his commandments. Verse 27, curse if you don't. In verse 28, that the whole section from chapter 1 to 11 comes down to this simple choice. Yes, I'm going to serve the Lord, or no, I'm going to reject him. And then he says in verse 29, when the Lord your God brings you into the land that you are entering to take possession of it, you shall set the blessing on Mount Gerizim and the curse on Mount Ebal. Are they not beyond the Jordan, west of the road, toward the going down of the sun, in the land of the Canaanites who live in the Arabah opposite Gilgal, beside the Oak of Morah? For you are to cross over the Jordan to go in and take possession of the land that the Lord your God is giving you. When you possess it and live in it, you shall be careful to do all the statutes and rules that I am setting before you. Now, I mentioned before that one of the elements of the covenant treaty, the suzerain treaty, is witnesses. But here, the witnesses that Moses is referring to are two mountains. And later on in the book, chapters 27 through 30, we see more details about this ceremony. And they were told to write on a stone all the curses and set that up on Mount Ebal. And they were to write on a stone all the blessings promised by God and put those on Mount Gerizim, that they would be a witness of the covenant choices that they were making. And now notice where he describes this. Set the blessing on Mount Gerizim and the curse on Mount Ebal. Are they not beyond the Jordan, west of the road, toward the going down of the sun, that is on the west side of the Jordan, in the land of the Canaanites who live there, beside the Oak of Morah? Now, does that ring a bell with anybody? Because this is not just a travelogue that he's giving them so that they can pinpoint the location, but it's actually referring them to the original land promise that God had made to Abraham. You remember in Genesis 12, Abraham is in Ur of the Chaldees, and the Lord spoke to him and go to a land that I will show you. And he leaves his family, well, what do you know, another glitch. Who could have ever foreseen something like that? So I was right in the middle of looking at the significance of the place names that Moses was telling the nation of Israel. And in this, we were looking at the choice that they have to make. And then Moses gives these two mountains, Mount Gerizim and Mount Ebal, and tells where they exist. In Genesis 12, God says to Abraham, I will make of you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and him who dishonors you I will curse, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. Then in verse Genesis 12, 6 and 7, Abram passed through the land to the place at Shechem, to the Oak of Morah. That's what Moses is referring to in this chapter in Deuteronomy. And then the Lord appeared to Abram and said, to your offspring I will give this land. So he built an altar there to the Lord who had appeared to him. So this, the place that Moses is talking about, is the very place that God gave the promise for the land in the first place. And so now they have... they will go across the Jordan into the Promised Land, and when they come to Shechem, which is related to the Oak of Morah, from there, if you look east, you can see to the north Mount Ebal, to the south Mount Gerizim, and the idea here is that you have a visible reminder of the covenant choice that you have to make all the days of your life. just as you had a sign you put on your hand or on your forehead or on your gates or on your doorpost, you have a visible sign of the choice that you have to make before God to either enter into his covenant promises or curses. And these, it's interesting to me anyway, there's something in the, it's repeated several times in the Bible about the blessing of the right hand. Presumably it's because the majority of people are right-handed, and therefore it represents their strength rather than weakness. And you recall how Jacob essentially adopted the two sons of Joseph and made them into two tribes rather than one for Joseph, the nation of Israel. And he blessed those boys. And when Moses brought them to Jacob, he reversed his hands and put his right hand to bless the younger rather than the older. And just, you know, Jacob had to cheat. Jacob had to cheat Esau to get this. But it was so easy for the Lord to say, this is going to be the predominant one and not. But the blessing of the right hand refers then in this situation to Mount Gerizim is on your right side, the blessing of God, and on the left, the curses of God if you're disobedient. And they say at times in the year that Mount Gerizim is green, it's fertile, and Mount Ebal is brown and dead. So Dennis Olson in his book Death of Moses says, like two billboards with neon lights flashing, the two mountains were visible and tangible reminders of the competing paths that Israel could walk. Disobedience and following after other gods, which leads to curse and death, versus obedience and the love of Yahweh alone, which leads to blessing and life. And this is a conclusion that Moses has of this section of chapters 1 through 11, is called to choose to serve the Lord, to walk with him. This is the same choice that we make throughout the Bible, whether in the prophets or the Psalms, or come to the New Testament. Jesus calls people to respond to him. When I came to faith, I knew nothing, but I knew this. When the Spirit of the Lord convicted me that Jesus was real, I knew I had to follow him. I didn't know what that meant. I didn't know what it entailed. I didn't know what it would mean, but I knew I had to follow him. That's the basic first step of discipleship, is choosing to follow the Master. And throughout the Bible, we have this call to follow him and be faithful to him. He took the first step. He delivered the nation from Egyptian bondage. He brings them into the promised land, and then he calls them to be faithful to him. Same with us. He delivered us from sin and death and the devil on the cross, and he brought new life, a miracle life in resurrection and the power of the Spirit, and then he calls us to follow him. And our answer is simple. It's yes or no. The one thing about the covenant treaty is that the vassal did not negotiate. The great king, the suzerain, said, these are the terms. The vassal has to either accept the terms or go to war. Israel has to accept the terms or rebel against them, as Korah, Dothan, and Abiram. And that's the choice that we have as well. We either, yes, Jesus, you are my Lord, or no, I won't follow. And in that, the expected answer for Moses and Jesus today, for us today, is yes. Yes, Lord, I will follow you. I will be faithful to you with your help. I can't be any more faithful than these Israelites unless you change me, unless you come and change my heart and take up your residence there, dwell, that I might be a sign for those around me, a covenant sign of God's blessing and goodness and faithfulness. For this, we ask in Jesus' name that you would do for us what we can't do for ourselves.